Ganley, this is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the sounds from the week's top Granite State headlines.
My constituents are writing me, but how can I help them when it's a situation of they're getting cancellation notices because of the way that Obamacare is drafted, when they can't access the website because it's such a mess? So absolutely, I want to help my constituents. But again, I would say to the president, why doesn't he call a timeout on this, understanding that it's not working right now?
I am heartened by the fact that folks I might call Medicaid expansion skeptics in the Senate are coming forward with their own ideas and plans, and I am open to all ideas.
The one thing that I'm most proud of is that we did it with a positive message. There was never a piece of mail that went out that was negative, and that's important to me.
It clearly appears to me Mr. Lozo seems to be using his position as a bail commissioner in a less than professional manner. It is clear when questioned by certain friends he will provide information indicating someone is working as an informant for the police, thereby protecting...
If police officers are gunned down and executed and there is no repercussions other than life in prison, how are we supposed to protect the public? How is the public supposed to feel if a police officer can be killed and then he can just go to prison?
From the top, that was U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte on the Affordable Care Act, Governor Maggie Hassan on Medicaid expansion, newly re-elected Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis, the Nashua Telegraph's Jonathan Van Fleet reading from a police report on Mayor Donna Lee Lozo's husband, and Manchester Police Chief David Maher after the state Supreme Court upheld the death penalty. One of the week's biggest stories developed late in the week, the ongoing saga of whether New Hampshire should extend Medicaid coverage to more low-income Granite Staters. A special legislative session on the matter opened yesterday, with the state Senate offering a new approach. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. We want your thoughts about the headlines of the week. Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, all one word, NHPR Exchange. Our guests for this week's roundup are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Norma Love, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good morning.
And also with us, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dean, I'm going to start with you just to give us, once again, that big picture about Medicaid. As I said, that special session opened yesterday. It's going to run for about 2 weeks. Just remind us why this is important, not just for New Hampshire, Dean, but for the national narrative about the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, well, as we've discussed before, part of the Affordable Care Act was an expansion of Medicaid in the states. The Supreme Court, while upholding the Affordable Care Act in general, specifically said that states should be given the right to decide whether or not to opt into the Medicaid expansion. If you decide to accept the Medicaid expansion, there's $2.5 billion that is available over 3 years, with the federal government then funding at 90% for, I think, the next 10 years. What we've seen is kind of a mixed response, which I think has actually surprised the Obama administration. Roughly half the states have accepted the money. A few have not yet decided. But this has sort of complicated the process of implementing Obamacare for people who are in need of Medicaid assistance. So, New Hampshire is in the process of deciding what to do. It can choose to expand in any quarter. So, if they don't decide now, they can decide again in the spring or in the summer. But there is some pressure to get this up and running. And I think what we're going to see as we talk about this is a debate in the state legislature over the extent to which this is simply going to be an extension of a federal program or some other kind of hybrid that involves the private marketplace or private insurers. I mean, this is sort of a fairly straightforward ideological debate over the reach of the federal government, the danger of unfunded mandates eventually if the federal funding dries up. And what we're seeing right now are the House and Senate and Governor Hassan kind of trying to figure, you know, they like to talk about sort of a New Hampshire solution. And I think we're going to see some kind of a hybrid that acknowledges the expansion but also relies to some extent on the private marketplace.
Yeah, and it did get pretty interesting over there yesterday, Gary. They set down the rules for how they wanted this special session to proceed. And then the state Senate presented a sort of new approach. Can you give us just a brief description of that?
Well, basically the House and the Senate have two competing plans. Which really aren't all that far apart if you really look at them. They're virtually identical in the first year, which is you would use an existing program called HIP, or a health insurance premium program, payment program, where if somebody is already on an employer's insurance, they qualify for Medicaid. Medicaid would pay for the premium for the private insurance. They all agree that this is what they should do. They're going to go to get a federal. They're going to try to get a federal waiver for that. And then in both cases, the House and Senate, those people who don't qualify for that in the first year would go on to the managed care Medicaid program,
sort of traditional Medicaid.
After that is where we get the difference. The Senate wants at the beginning of 2015 to put everybody into the exchanges or the marketplaces. And so everyone from 100% to 138% of the poverty level would be put onto the exchange. And with obviously the premiums would be paid for by Medicaid. But the House doesn't want to do that. They want to put that off for about 3 years. And that's where the big problem is. And that's where the big sticking point is. And at the end of 2014, if they don't have the federal waiver, the Senate wants to end the program. And the House wants to extend that out a ways, and that's where the negotiations obviously are going to be. And the other sticking point is the who gets put onto the exchange. The House wants to use 100 to 138% of poverty, whereas the Senate wants everybody of the newly eligible into the exchange.
And what about the folks who are already on Medicaid under the old system? They continue as always. Wow. Norma, I'd love your thoughts on this, too. It's real interesting what Gary's telling us.
Well, I think that what you're going to see is you'll have a hearing on Tuesday, probably each separate Senate and House hearing on each of their plans. But the work's going to happen behind closed doors. So you'll have hearings on these plans, and then the idea would be they would have work sessions. And then on the 21st, hopefully something will emerge. If nothing emerges, there'll be a lot of finger-pointing about who had the highest political loss in this. And I think people would say, well, you know, for the Republicans to step forward and say, hey, the rest of the country is saying no exchanges, we want to use the exchange. And they're saying it's a fact of the law, it's a fact of life, we hope it's fixed in the next year. But yes, that's what we would do. They would use what Gary described as the employer-sponsored plan, or the HIP. There's supposedly a lot of savings in that, and they would use that savings to help pay for the difference in buying private plans, which are generally going to be higher because Medicaid only pays 54 cents on the dollar. And their whole push is we want our providers to get the most money. They're going to get more money out of private insurance than they are Medicaid. So the providers are behind the scenes, the hospitals who have these networks, they want something done. I don't think they're really necessarily on one side or the other. They just want something done because $2.4 billion over 7 years is a lot of money. I don't think the consumers out there who would benefit from this are probably tuned in at all.
All right. So the providers are definitely weighing in because they stand to gain. The question is which approach they stand to gain more from, Norma. Medicaid, as you said, doesn't pay fully, if we could put it that way. Private insurance, if you covered folks that way, might give the providers a little bit more money.
They would get more money, but either way, they want something. And right now, they call it uncompensated care, or basically care that you provide and you're not paid for. They would like that to be reduced by getting at least some money from people who aren't paying now. And if they're put through Medicaid and they get 54 cents on the dollar, they're getting something more than they're getting for free care.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We'd love to hear from you, your comments, questions, thoughts about some of the top headlines of the week here in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, all one word, NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Dean, one more quick question on this Medicaid story. And again, I'm turning to you for the sort of national as well as New Hampshire picture. It's interesting to me that more people are saying in the state legislature now, let's use the marketplaces or the health exchanges, call them what you will. Whereas, you know, on the other side, people are saying they're not working. Let's shut them down for a little while and fix them. So it's almost like people are looking to these as a solution. At the same time, people are looking to them as a big problem.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think a couple things are going on. I think, you know, at the most kind of basic political level, I think Republicans would prefer to not have to deal with the marketplaces at all. That's a well-established fact. They would prefer to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But I think, you know, what we're seeing at this second layer of rather than having just a expansion of a federal program, using private insurance, using the marketplaces to kind of maximize the reimbursement rate, as Norma was saying, you know, I think that's sort of a more of an ideological issue. So one is kind of a sort of a practical political issue about shutting down the legislation. The other is, you know, if you're going to do this, then there are these kinds of ideological considerations about how you implement it. So that is also happening at the national level as well, where members of Congress are saying, you know, Republicans are saying we don't particularly want this law. But if we are going to do something, let's do it in a way that kind of makes sense in terms of our principles about the private economy, marketplace, business incentives, et cetera. So I think that's what you're seeing and that you're going to see in the state legislature is, sure, there are plenty of Republicans in the Senate who don't like the Affordable Care Act. But if the state is going to do this, do it in a way that is ideologically consistent with their views on private versus public reach in healthcare.
All right. Last quick question for you, Gary Reno. So what's next? Are they going to meet every day for 2 weeks?
No, they're going to have public hearings on the two bills on Tuesday. After that, they'll do some committee work, and then there'll be committees will decide what they're going to do, their recommendations. And then they'll all come back together on the 21st.
All right. After a short break, I want to talk about another big story of the week. And Norm, I'm going to turn to you first on this one. This is the state Supreme Court's ruling on the death penalty. We'll talk about that and a lot more coming up. The number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match their employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Flexible MBA at the University of New Hampshire for working professionals, evenings, weekends, or online. AACSB accredited in a new business school facility, mba.unh.edu. From Hawley Oil, a full-service oil company, keeping New Hampshire families warm since 1961, delivering bioheat in Manchester, Concord, and surrounding towns, Hawley Oil, HALLEOIL.com. And CASA, thanking the hundreds of volunteers who make a difference every day in the lives of New Hampshire's abused children. Details about how you can lift up a child's life at CASANH.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. We've already talked about the state legislature opening a special session to decide Medicaid expansion. We're also going to be looking at the death penalty ruling from the state Supreme Court this week. Also, local elections held around the state this week. Those and other stories. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Norma Love, let's talk briefly about the state Supreme Court ruling on the death penalty this week. Now, we did a whole program on this yesterday, but I did want to get your thoughts, Norma. You've covered many debates on this issue in the past. What stood out for you, Norma, on this ruling released just Wednesday?
I wasn't sure they were going to uphold the law. I thought that they might find that there were problems with the law and find a way to give him life. Instead, what they did was they upheld the conviction and they said, all right, we're going to now examine whether the death sentence itself was fair and look at other comparable sentences around the country.
In his particular case, not broadly.
In his particular case. It's the first death row inmate we've had in, I think, since 1959. And then we had, of course, the National Supreme Court rulings that ended up throwing out capital punishment laws all over the country. So, but we haven't executed anybody in this state since, I think it was 1939. So I think there's a real sense of, wow, they upheld this law, what next? And meanwhile, in the legislature, they're working to repeal it. We have a governor who says she would sign a repeal law if it didn't affect the verdict yesterday in Michael Addison's case.
Yeah, and Gary, to that bill that Norma mentioned, what does this big ruling the other day, 243 pages, what does it mean for the efforts of those working on this bill to repeal the death penalty?
They had already started kicking up the campaign to push his bill through. It's certainly going to give it more incentive. I think they're going to be turning it up even higher now that this has come through and said basically it's constitutional. So the issue has always been the Senate and what the Senate will do, because most people expect the House to pass the bill. And the question is what the Senate's going to do with it. And if it gets through the Senate, then you have a governor who says she will entertain it anyway, which has not been the case here for quite some time.
Entertain signing a repeal.
Sign
of, yeah. All right. Well, we'll be following up on that for sure when the session opens. Norma.
One quick note is that just a couple of years ago, we strengthened the death penalty under a totally different legislature after the horrible killing in Mount Vernon. So I think it's going to be interesting to see if indeed we've had such a turnaround in the Senate.
All right. 1-800-892-6477 again is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our Facebook page is NHPR Exchange, all one word. I did want to quickly catch up with all of you on the state elections that were held this week. It seems like a long time ago. It was just Tuesday. Gary Rayner, what were some of the most important races around New Hampshire this past week?
Well, everybody was watching the mayoral race in Manchester. And because everybody thought it was going to – Ted Gatzis last time around won by an overwhelming majority. And everybody thought that, you know, this is a race to watch to see how this one comes out.
It's the state's biggest city. About 10% of the population lives there.
And what Manchester proved is that Manchester is not Boston, and they're not going to have a mayor for 20 years. the shelf life for a mayor of Manchester is pretty small. And it was a lot closer race than you might suspect. It was about 1,000 votes that Ted Gatzis beat Alderman Tom Arnold by. And it's certainly, if there's been a lot of chat around about whether this was going to be Ted Gatzis' jumping off point for the race for governor at some point, it certainly kind of put a little damper on that. It was so close.
Interesting. All right. Well, and what else stuck up for you? I want to hear from all three of you. But, Gary, what other races were you looking at?
I think the one in Portsmouth was pretty interesting. We had Governor Shaheen's oldest daughter, Stephanie, running for the first time for the city council in Portsmouth. She finished third. The person who got the – Portsmouth had their very strange way of picking their mayor. Everybody runs at large, and the one who gets the most votes is the mayor.
Even if they don't want to be the mayor.
Right. And the person who is mayor is the assistant mayor now, and it's his third time he's sort of run for mayor, and he finally – Bob Lister, he's a former superintendent of schools there. Jim Boulay here in Concord, I guess the most interesting thing is he lost 2 points from the last election. Instead of 85% of the vote, he got 83%.
Well, those are beyond John Lynch's numbers.
They are.
By the way, in Portsmouth, Jim Splaine, longtime state representative.
And senator, he finished second. He's going to be the assistant mayor.
Okay. Norma, what were you watching? And Dean, go ahead.
Well, I was living in the Concord area. I think I was watching the Concord races, and Amanda Grady Sexton was elected. And she also is one of the spokespeople for the Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. So I've worked with her a lot, and that was one of the ones I was watching.
Yeah. And how about you, Dean?
Similar to what both Gary and Norma have said, you know, Manchester was very interesting. You know, Ted Gatzis winning his third term by a very narrow margin, got 70% of the vote 2 years ago. I think in Concord, in contrast, Jim Boulay may be mayor for the next 20 years. He's not had serious opposition. We've had some big issues in Concord, the Main Street redevelopment, the Bearcat the shift from parking meters to kiosks, which was a big deal to people who live in the city. So these kinds of sort of, you know, community issues, city issues, and he seems to be still be quite popular. You know, Portsmouth was interesting to see. Gene Shaheen's daughter got one of the seats on the council. I don't know if that's the beginning of some career or just something that she's interested in doing. You know, this is for me, given what I study, this is sort of the mellowest, kind of least interesting of the cycle. Now we're gearing up for the midterm and then the presidential over the next 3 years.
Well, and the national media, as you know, Dean, was focused a lot this week on the results in New Jersey with Governor Chris Christie being reelected, and in Virginia with a Democrat being elected there. And that New Jersey race has some New Hampshire spillover, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is very interesting. I just mentioned the presidential primary, and it sounds like, you know, we're starting to move into that cycle. The New Hampshire GOP hired a new executive director, Matt Mowers. He was Chris Christie's regional political director. He managed 8 New Jersey counties. He's worked with Christie for the past 3 years. So literally he was hired right after, you know, Christie had his big win. Interestingly enough, Mowers did not mention the New Hampshire primary at all in kind of talking about the transition, because, you know, if Christie runs for president, they don't want to be seen as though this gives him some sort of an advantage. It may say something about the kinds of candidates that the party may actively try to recruit in the future, or the way that it goes about fundraising. I don't know. We'll see. The GOP also hired a new field director, Bobby Collins, who had a similar role to Mowers, but in Virginia, with the Virginia governor's race, in which very conservative Ken Cuccinelli lost by 2 points to Terry McAuliffe, sort of a perennial Democratic fundraiser and mover and shaker, former chair of the party. You know, now that the election cycle is over, it's all going to start to trickle up here to New Hampshire.
All right. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Norma Love, I did want to ask you one more election-related question. This has to do with the U.S. Senate race coming up in 2014. Gene Shaheen up for re-election this week. Former 2nd District Congressman Charlie Bass said, "I'm not interested." Were you surprised?
Not really. I saw Charlie on Friday up at, they were having a ceremony for Ray Burton, who's not well. And he looked awfully relaxed for somebody who was getting ready to launch a campaign.
Wasn't he riding with Gene Shaheen in the car?
Oh, he may have been. But, you know, I think the loss for Charlie against Ann McLean Custer was pretty tough. I think they thought they'd run a very good campaign. In fact, I think they thought they were going to win that. And the 2nd District is a little harder than the 1st District for Republicans, but Charlie thought he was going to win that. He'd run a good campaign. And when it came out that she won, I think it was very, very hard. And you put your heart and soul into something like that, and you have to think long and hard about whether you want to do that again. He also made a comment about he didn't want to take personal attacks from Democrats, and he was just tired of it. So, you get to a point where maybe it's time.
Yeah, and he's also interested in energy issues, and he's working on a lot of those projects and maybe finding a passion there. Go ahead, Gary.
And he's a long line of name Republicans who have said that they're not interested in running for the state Senate. I mean, we had Bob Smith earlier saying that he was interested in it, and he said he wasn't. And then State Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley said a little while ago he wasn't. So now we have Jim Rubens and Karen Testerman running, and of course, this leaves a wide open door to Scott Brown if he's interested.
Which we talked about last week, so I won't pick up on that right now. I do want to, again, invite our listeners to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So as we talk about this U.S. Senate race, I do want to talk about the other U.S. Senator from New Hampshire, Dean Spiliotis, Kelly Ayotte. Boy, making a lot of news over the past couple weeks. First, earlier this week, for her continued critique of the Affordable Care Act. This made national news. What did Senator Ayotte say, Dean?
Well, she was on the Sunday morning talk show on CNN this past weekend. I actually happened to be watching and saw her do this live. And she said that she wanted the administration to take a timeout on the health exchange, essentially to temporarily shut down the website. She's not the only Republican to suggest this, but to basically take the marketplace offline, fix it, and then put it back online, you know, which would delay the entire process. It's funny when she used the phrase timeout, I thought of, you know, an unruly preschool student that needs a child that needs a timeout. You know, the other thing she said was have a timeout, take it offline, and work together for a bipartisan fix with legislative leaders. And I can't think of anything right now that the Obama administration probably wants to do less is that then convene a meeting of bipartisan leaders in Congress to sort of start all over again on this. They're just trying to sort of, you know, white knuckle it through this difficult period and get on with the marketplaces. I can't imagine they want to take it offline and throw it back open to a bipartisan a group of congressional leaders. You know, Jeanne Shaheen, in contrast, is not suggesting taking it offline, but she wants to extend the March 31st deadline to make sure everybody who needs insurance has an opportunity to register. So, yeah, another sort of big moment for Kelly Ayotte. It's not going to happen. But it was interesting
this
to hear.
Time out, you mean?
Yeah, it's just, no, they're just not interested in doing this.
Well, and then a little bit later in the week, Norma, Senator Ayotte made news again, voting in favor of a bill called ENDA, siding with Democrats. Now, what does ENDA stand for, Norma, and why was this considered a difficult vote for Senator Ayotte?
Well, it's a law that, or if it passes the House, which is doubtful, that would protect you in the workplace based on gender and sexual orientation issues. And we had something in New Hampshire, a fight like this several years ago, where we had, it was called the bathroom bill, because people were afraid that transgender people would go into the opposing bathroom and expose themselves somehow to people of the same sex. And so it was defeated here. We do have a law in this state against discrimination based on sexual orientation. And I think what Kelly Ayotte did was she put into that bill, or helped put into that bill, an amendment that would exempt religious institutions. So if you're the Catholic Church, for example, or you wouldn't have to abide by this. You could go by your religious teachings.
And how did that go over in the U.S. Senate? What sort of a difference did that make?
Well, it passed 64 to 32 or something like that. So, I mean, it got a good vote in the Senate, and I think it's probably a historic vote in the Senate. But Boehner has already said that it's dead in the House.
House Speaker John Boehner. You know, here's an email that came in a couple minutes ago on this topic. Christopher in Manchester writes, both our U.S. senators appear to be staking their ground to the political middle. Jeanne Shaheen, parentheses, delay on health care, and Kelly Ayotte, only one of 10 Republicans for anti-discrimination bill. Christopher says, based on the purple nature of our state, it makes a lot of sense. Dean Spiliotis, you want to jump in on that?
Yes, absolutely. Just first to go back to the Senate bill, you know, it had some religious protections in it. Ayotte and a number of other senators wanted to strengthen that exemption. That amendment did not make it into the final version of the bill that passed. So she supported the bill even without that particular religious exemption. This idea has been around for a long time. Back in 1996, a similar bill, I think, failed by one vote in the U.S. Senate. And that's like when President Clinton passed the Defense of Marriage Act. So it was a very different time politically. In 2007, I think a version passed the House, but it did not have the gender identity component. It was just a sexual orientation bill. You know, absolutely, for Kelly Ayotte, you know, I think it made sense for her to vote the way that she did. You know, she's a senator from a state that's libertarian, that has gay marriage. You know, we've talked a lot about how she positions herself kind of between the Tea Party and establishment Republicans, and she sort of has been pretty successful at straddling or that line or having that balance so far. So I think it would have surprised me if she had voted against this.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the email, Christopher. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our Facebook page is NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Gary Rayner, I want to ask you about a state senator who had a tough week. Martha Fuller Clark, what happened?
Well, she said she blanked out at the wheel of the car and went onto the curb and hit a pedestrian. And it was the second accident that she's had in about 2 months. Earlier, she took out a road sign. And as a result, she said that she's not driving again, and the Portsmouth police are starting administrative proceedings to see if she should retain her license.
Yeah.
Now, she has had sleep problems in the past. She was diagnosed with sleep apnea. There was some very well-publicized videos of her sleeping in the house, in a New Hampshire house at one point. So it's a problem that seems to be reoccurring again.
Well, meanwhile, Senator Clark this week was trying to promote a bill, Dean Spiliotis, for Juneteenth to be observed in New Hampshire. And a lot of people would say, June what? But what is that?
Juneteenth is June 19th, 1865. It's when Texas abolished slavery, emancipation of slaves. It then became kind of a nationalized holiday to celebrate the emancipation of slavery. And if New Hampshire were to adopt this legislation proposed by Senator Fuller Clark, we'd be the 43rd state to celebrate it. She is not proposing a state holiday. It's more kind of a recognition. So in that sense, it's less complicated to pass something like this. You know, as we know, we had a 20-year battle here to have the Martin Luther King holiday recognized finally in 1999. But it's sort of recognizing Juneteenth, National Freedom Day, recognizing the end of slavery, emancipation of American slaves. But again, not a sort of full-fledged holiday, more of a recognition and a celebration.
All right. And here's an email that just came in from Robert in Epsom, who says, regarding the Affordable Care Act, I'm a Democrat, and I don't want to give my guy a complete pass for not being accurate when the president said, if you like your plan, you can keep it. But, Robert says, nobody is mentioning the fact that people's plans usually change yearly anyway, usually more money for less coverage. Anyone want to comment on Robert's email there? Norma.
I think one of the things that is causing some of the angst is these plans have to have these essential benefits. And the essential benefits you may not need, even though your plan may have already had it before. I mean, it's hard to know whether you had maternity coverage or child dental coverage and you're 70 years old. I mean, I'm sorry, 70 you'd be on Medicare, but something, an elderly person versus a younger person, there's a difference.
So everyone's idea of essential is different, and
right.
That's the problem.
And that's one of the things the insurance companies are saying is costing more money and why they're raising premiums, because they now have to provide coverage, particularly for, I think, maternity care is quite expensive.
Yeah, this is a whole other show, I'm thinking, Dean, but go ahead.
Absolutely. And this has been fascinating to me because this is a classic example of where what you say in a campaign conflicts with the reality of the situation and gets you into trouble. You know, we've all seen clips of President Obama saying, you can keep your doctor, you can keep your plan, period. He actually uses the word period. In my mind, that means no exceptions. Now, it turns out that people in the administration knew that some of these existing plans would not meet the minimum criteria of the Affordable Care Act and would have to be canceled. And then the idea is you get onto the exchange, you get better coverage, it's supposed to be cheaper, et cetera. So it's, in theory, a good deal for you. What they should have said is most Americans will get to keep their plans. But they didn't say that, and it's caused a real firestorm. He finally apologized for saying that yesterday. You can see the video on the web.
All right, Robert, thanks for the email. The email address for you to join us is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And then there's the phone number, 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Reams Show, the Friday News Roundup. Health and Human Services Secretary Sebelius rejects calls to delay parts of the Affordable Care Act. Then, Geneva talks on Syria stall as negotiators fail to agree on conditions. All coming up on the Diane Reams Show.
The Diane Reams Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Restaurant Week Portsmouth and the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 45 restaurants November 7th to the 16th. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. MBAE Systems, remembering our servicemen and women and emergency response professionals and their commitment to our country and communities on this Veterans Day. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday on The Exchange for Veterans Day, we bring you our earlier conversation with the author of The Last of the Doughboys. It's about those who fought in World War I. Join us Monday morning at 9 for that conversation. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us now with a phone call at 1-800-892-6477. 6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And Gary Reno, before we go back to our listeners, I did want to follow up with you on a story we talked about last week, some political troubles for the mayor of Nashua and her husband. Now, again, we talked about this last week. There was an investigation that was opened up. What developed this week, Gary?
Well, it seemed to be more back and forth between the mayor and the police department, and police unions. This week, the more information was released. I believe through her husband decided to release parts of the investigative report. And the two of them are holding a press conference today, and where they're trying to get their side of the story out.
Yeah, tough story. And yes. Another public official, Norma Love, also had some tough headlines this week. Jim Reams, longtime county attorney in Rockingham County, was, I'm quoting from the Nashua Telegraph here, stripped of his prosecutorial authority, told not to return to his office. The U.S. Attorney's Office is now getting involved. Wow, Norma, I was taken aback by this.
I haven't seen anything like it. I mean, I think it's very, very unusual, and I don't think it doesn't bode well for that office and the three people who are on suspension.
Yeah, and it seemed like as much as I tried to find out as much as I could before we went on the air today, nobody's really saying anything.
No, and I'm not surprised at that. When you have the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney, and the FBI involved in something, usually they're very, very tight-lipped.
Yeah. All right. Anyone else know anything about this? All right. Well, I'm sure more will be coming out over the weekend. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Gary, the state of New Hampshire got a little bit of good news this week from a national settlement from drug maker Johnson & Johnson. Sometimes there are these big national settlements, right, and New Hampshire gets a little bit of the pie. What happened this time?
Well, New Hampshire's going to get a couple million dollars out of this. Basically,
$3.8 million.
And Johnson & Johnson had two drugs in particular that were approved for various things. And what they were doing was marketing them for other
unapproved uses.
And so the federal government and various other people came in and said, hey, you can't do that, and we're stepping in. Now, some of this money may end up having to go to the Medicaid program, but it's a general settlement, so most of the money probably does come back here to New Hampshire.
There was some settlement money earlier this year, Norma, too, that we talked about, right, that came in for New Hampshire from another national settlement.
And we've had several settlements. Yeah. I'm not sure how much they've added up to at this point. I would like to go back to something, though, that Gary said about this. Unapproved uses. I can understand where the state has gone after this, particularly if it's an expensive drug. But that's happening more and more, where you'll find that a particular drug, while it's the one I can think of is a relative used for a shot in the back of the eye to shut off bleeding to save the eye.
Wow.
The drug is actually used for colon cancer. So you had to pay cash for it. Medicare wouldn't cover it. So there are sometimes experimental uses for drugs that are out there that are working. And I'm not sure the terms of this one, but certainly if it involved using drugs at New Hampshire state facilities, very expensive drugs, and they weren't using them correctly, I can see that.
Well, let me read from the Concord Monitor, and then, Dino, ask you your thoughts. The settlement is part of a $2.2 billion agreement in which a unit of the company will plead guilty to a misdemeanor criminal charge over misbranding, I hope I pronounce this right, Risperdal, for uses not approved by the FDA, including treating elderly patients with dementia. So that may be where Medicaid and Medicare come in. Go ahead, Dean, your thoughts.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that, you know, this is essentially a settlement for improper marketing for sales of an antipsychotic drug. I think that Norma raises a fascinating question. I, too, have heard of people who are be treated with a drug that is intended for one type of issue but is used successfully in a different way, this kind of so-called off-label use of the drug. You know, it may mean in the future sort of a rethinking of federal regulations on this if in the process of getting familiar with how these drugs work, they find new uses for them, you then have to make adjustments. But, yeah, it is, you know, $2 billion national settlement. We're getting a little piece of it.
Okay. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. A couple more fun stories, if I could put it that way, that I wanted to cover with all of you. To you first, Dean, I think the New Hampshire State Supreme Court as we said, heard about, you know, released its opinion on the death penalty on Wednesday. Yesterday, it heard a case regarding vanity plates and what you can and can't say on those plates. Just gives you a sense of the variety of issues that, that the justices deal with. But what is this all about?
This is a fascinating story. Anybody who lives in New Hampshire for a while notices there are a lot of vanity plates in this state. They're fairly affordable. They're easy to get. You do have to go through a process in which the DMV has the option of refusing a plate due to obscenity, profanity, or some sort of defamatory wording. So the plate at issue here is a Rochester man who applied for the plate, Cops Lie. So basically a statement about his belief of corruption in law enforcement and the government. A state DMV worker denied it. According to the state, has the right to deny it if they decide that it's inflammatory. The supervisor of the DMV denied it. It went to a court. The court upheld the denial. Now we're at the Supreme Court level, in which this individual is getting help from the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union to argue that it's a free speech issue to be able to say cops lie. You know, they had the hearing. They had the oral argument. A lot of questions about kind of the vagueness and the subjectiveness of how these plates are denied or later revoked if it turns out that there's some kind of code that, that actually was something that was obscene or defamatory. So this is actually a fascinating issue. We're going to see, you know, sort of the Supreme Court of the state is going to weigh in on essentially a free speech versus governmental oversight issue.
Yeah, and it's interesting. According to the Associated Press, the justices asked some skeptical questions for the Attorney General's office, which was defending the DMV in this case. Chief Justice Delanus asked, so if a person at the DMV agrees with the sentiment, he gets the plate? What do you think, Norma? I'd love your thoughts there.
I think there one example was, what if the plate said cops are great? I mean, who decides which sentiment is free speech? And I think the person who got the plate or wants the plate, I think he wanted to yank the police chain when they stopped him.
Well, what's so fascinating to me is that apparently after the cops lie plate was rejected, he got accepted the license plate that says great government. So his argument now is, okay, so if you say bad things about government, it's rejected. If you say good things about government, it's approved. That's an unfair. So this is a bit of an interesting kind of challenge going on here. And I'm sure, you know, free speech advocates and libertarians around the country, as was true with the Bearcat, will be watching this as well.
Well, you know, many years ago, those of us who've been here from New Hampshire for a long time will remember that this is already, some similar issue has already gone to the Supreme Court. And it concerned the live free or die motto on a state plate, where somebody put Vaseline on it so that it would black it out and you couldn't see it. And the whole thing went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the person could do that.
Yeah, because the person didn't like Live Free or Die. I do remember that. And there have been other instances of other plates. I think there was an anti-DHHS plate. That was an issue. So, Norma.
It'll be kind of interesting to find out if, I mean, if you carry a sign, that's free speech. But if you're buying a license plate, essentially, to put on a vehicle, there's a government involvement there. I think it'll be interesting to see where they, how they come down with a procedure that, you know, determines, as Dean said, what's the good government or bad government? What's the right way to go?
Right. And there is a danger of kind of an arbitrariness if it's up to an individual. You know, the state worker you get on that day who thinks it's defamatory can say no, but on a different day you get somebody who's, oh, that's okay with me, and then they get it. That's, I think, what the justices were getting at.
And there have been some that have gone through the prison manufacturing system that have made it out into society that have been questioned later.
Well, yeah, there are other examples. I think, I'm not 100% sure here, but drunk, I think, was one in question. Jesus was one in question. So, all right, we like to express ourselves in our license plates. I think that's clear. A couple emails have come in. Here's one from Bill, who says, on the death penalty, although strengthened by the legislature over the Mont Vernon killings, Bill says no one has been executed or appears to be going to be. Bill says the push to execute Briggs's killer was grandstanding by Ms. Ayotte for political gain. He goes on to say, you cannot execute one and not the others. I'm not quite sure what he means by that.
Probably, but he's referring to John Brooks.
Oh, yes, that's
he
right.
He was a
murder
for hire, and there were two capital cases going on at the same time. Right.
John Brooks was white and
white and wealthy, and he was given life, and Michael Addison was given death.
Mm. Do you want to jump in there, Gary?
I mean, it's I suppose that's true, and I mean, the charge about this the Addison case being politically motivated by for Kelly Ayotte, as she was using this to jump through the U.S. Senate eventually. But I mean, it was a tough case. I mean, I sat through some of that trial, and it was a tough
really?
Case.
Really? Yeah. All right. Well, Bill, thanks for the email. You can email us too, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's a comment that just came in on our Facebook page from Marie. She says, I'm listening this morning and wanted to clarify something about off-label drug use. Doctors can prescribe a medicine for off-label use. However, drug companies are strictly prohibited from marketing drugs for non-approved uses. I think that's where what you were getting to as well, Norm, that doctors can do this in the best of their discretion and understanding.
Right, and I think that's why this drug, which was used to shrink tumors in another part of the body, was used to shrink the bleeding blood vessels in the back of the eye. I think they're using it for certain kinds of macular degeneration. But it was not covered by Medicare as a result because it was not the prescribed use.
Yeah, but I think Marie's on target there. Doctors can use their discretion, but drug companies are absolutely not supposed to say, hey, folks, you can use this for, you know, acne or
right.
whatever.
Right. Couple
more quick stories that I wanted to get to with you guys. And one of them, Dean, is about a beloved figure in New Hampshire history, former New Hampshire Republican Governor John Winant, may finally get a statue on the State House lawn. Just remind us who he was and why he's received more attention lately.
Sure. He was a three-term Republican governor of New Hampshire. He was the first chairman of the Social Security Board. For some, best known as U.S. Ambassador to London in World War II, so he had a role in that as well. There had been some ongoing discussion about, you know, whether or not he should have a statue. I guess the bill said to have a statue, but not on the Capitol grounds. So there's some discussion about putting a statue to him on the grounds of the New Hampshire State Library right across the street. He was a St. Paul's alum. He taught at St. Paul's. He's buried there. There's been some interest from the school to getting involved in this as well. There's Winant Park over by St. Paul's, so anybody who drives over in that part of Concord. And there was even some discussion. I remember the Abbott Downing Elementary School in the south end of Concord, his name was one of the finalists for the school.
Oh,
so
wow.
There has been this sort of push to recognize this former governor in some way and also acknowledge his service during World War II. And so we may get a statue of him at some point near the Capitol.
Yeah, and really impressive figure. I mean, governor, Social Security Administration.
Ambassador. Sure.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens with that. And another beloved New Hampshire figure, Gary Reno, Robert Frost. NHPR reported this week on a pretty big discovery regarding one of New Hampshire's favorite poets. What did they find?
Well, somebody was cleaning out a closet in the Frost homestead up in Franconia, and they found this piece of wood that had basically a mailing label on it, which was used to send his books back from London to the United States.
Because he lived in England for a time.
For a time. And what's kind of interesting about that is when he left to go to England, he was basically a high school teacher and a farmer. And when he came back, he was a famous American poet. And in between, he collected all these books. Evidently, he was a great collector of books when he was in England. And they were shipped back. And part of that shipping crate was used as to prop up some shelves in a closet in his home in Franconia.
Any new poems there?
Well, maybe if you just take the shipping label and start reading down, who knows what you'll find. Maybe it'll be in pentameter, you know?
It's funny. Someone on our staff said, so what was in there? Was it his grocery list? What was it? So we're all hoping that maybe something really interesting and new will come out of this. Well, I always like to close out this hour with finding out what you folks will be following next week. Boy, there's a lot going on. Next week, The Exchange will be looking at the issue of police training around the use of deadly force given to recent fatal shootings of suspects that we've talked about on this roundtable. So we're going to be following up with a whole hour on that. And there's also a statewide conversation kicking off next week about our mental health system. We're going to be tapping into that as well, looking at just how the mental health system should spend very limited dollars. Those are two things we're going to be looking at. Norma, how about you?
Well, I'm going to be following Medicaid expansion, the gift that never stops giving, the hearings on Tuesday. We don't know the times yet. They may be out later today, but We'll be doing that and then following the how the progress of that bill goes and trying to find out what's going on behind the closed doors.
Well, and that Senate alternative is real interesting. I don't think anybody has tried this approach in the country yet, Norma, so you've got some studying up to do.
Arkansas has, and some states have in kind of a different form, but no state is the same.
Yeah. Mm. Gary, how about you?
Well, I think Medicaid expansion is just about most of what the week will be.
Anything else on your plate, Gary, next week? Or are you basically shuttered at the State House?
I was shuttered at the State House, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to write about down, about Medicaid expansion and various other things. And also some committees are finishing up their work, what they call retain bills. They hold on to bills for the year. They don't bring them to the floor, and they have to all come up in the first 3 days of the next legislative session. So some of these committees are working their way through the bills, and they're meeting now to decide what their recommendations are going to be, and there's a lot of bills like that.
Yeah, and the Gambling Commission is also preparing for its report, right? They have to come out with something
in
December.
They're not meeting again until the 22nd, when they're going to be doing some supposedly reviewing drafts of two bills or maybe part of a report. They want to separate out charitable gaming. They think there's some serious fixes needed with the regulations governing particularly table games, which just took off after the law was changed in 2006 to allow private operators.
How about you, Dean? What are you going to be tracking?
Well, you know, our congressional delegation and the implementation of Obamacare has just been endlessly interesting. I think that's going to continue to be the case. For me, you know, once we get that off-year election out of the way, the next day the midterm election cycle begins. So from now on until November of 2014, it's going to be all about the congressional seats and balance of power in Washington, and that has the big implications for a lot of policy areas.
All right. All stuff. I can see you getting excited already, Dean. All stuff that I know you love to talk about. Dean, thank you for being here.
Sure. My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. His website is nhpoliticalcapital.com. Norma Love, great to see you. Thank you.
Great to see you, Laura.
Norma Love, Statehouse reporter for the Associated Press. Gary Reno, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, the debate over recent fatal police shootings of suspects, how these cases are handled, and what officer training says about the use of deadly force. Then New Hampshire's mental health system. As a statewide conversation kicks off, we ask how best to spend limited funds. Later, U.S. foreign policy tilts toward Asia. We talk with Harvard scholar Kathleen Maloney. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from your members, and support also comes to us from New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits and the Hoffman Haas Fellowship, helping nonprofits populate boards with prepared and energetic leaders, accepting applications at nhnonprofits.org. And from Comcast Business, working to close the digital divide by encouraging educators, students, and families in need to learn more about the Internet Essentials program, internetessentials.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The US economy adds 204,000 jobs in October, a stronger-than-expected number. President Obama apologizes to Americans for not doing enough to protect people from having their insurance policies cancelled under the Affordable Care Act. The Senate passes legislation that